Knock the dust off of this.
Everything sucks. Just kidding. Everything is great. No, really, I haven't thought about my ex today. Oh, wait. Fuck, I just did.
But I went. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another Bad Weather podcast after a long hiatus. Yes, we are back. I'm one of the hosts, JP Hurley. Joining me this week is...
This is the sound of my voice. I remembered how to do it. Jonathan wow. Miller.
That's like the only thing that we had scripted for this entire show. Otherwise, we're just going to wing it.
Yeah, just flying by the seat of our tight pants.
Tight leather hot pants.
Hot pants. They go all the way halfway to the knee.
I had to put some baby powder on to get mine. One baby powder leg at a time.
That's a good after 40 tip for all those fellas out there. A little baby powder down the shorts. Doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, you and I were the same people, you know? Like, we both put pants on. The only difference is when I put pants on, I make gold records.
Oh, I put them on three legs at a time.
Oh, God.
So I put mine on.
Oh, God.
We should
probably quickly transition to the third leg of this podcast and move on from the intro.
Well, let's start. Hold on now. We got important business to take care of.
Yes. Give us important business. Give us your
business.
What are
you drinking? What are you drinking there?
Well, this is going to tie into later in the show, but I'm drinking a very healthy poppy soda, which has 25 calories, but it's well known for its prebiotics. I have no idea what that does for your gut health, but I know that it does something. So I'm going to drink poppy prebiotic, delicious strawberry lemon. Goes down smooth.
Goes down smooth. I am having a Bai Wonder Water, BAI, I think you say it Bai. It's a insert your own Bai Curious joke here for our buddy Luke, who loves to make a Bai Curious joke.
That's great. I mean, is it Wonder Water because you wonder if it's really water in there, or what's the deal?
Yeah, I'm stumped. I find myself opening it up and going, "You're my Wonder Water."
Oh, right. I love it. We got a great jingle for the new sponsor of the podcast, Bai.
Bai. And if we can clear it with Oasis, we're gold.
Enjoy a crisp, delicious, refreshing Bai Wonder Water.
But if you're Bai curious, Bai Wonder Water.
if you're Bai curious, Bai.
Yeah, right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's not good. There's a lot of possibilities here. Yep.
Great pod.
Just going to be just a bunch of shitty jokes about potential commercials.
Well, let me move us off of this goddamn ridiculous topic, and maybe we just talk about the last month.
I'll kick us off. This is going to be a little bit of a disclaimer at the top of this podcast. This is one that's pretty heavy. So have like a box of tissues beside you, maybe. But also like a pen and some paper. The whole purpose of this show is to educate. And I'm sorry I'm setting this up for so long, but this is not something that I intended to put on a public platform, but the message is too powerful to bypass, and no pun intended.
I agree with that. Yeah. And obviously, you know, share as much or as little as you want. I only wanted to give you the opportunity to start it off, to kind of go about, you know, what we've been up to the last month, and then I can fill in gaps or add my own context. I have a personal story here that kind of relates at some point as well. So go right ahead. Where we've been.
Okay, here we go. I'm gonna start this off. So a few short weeks ago, it was a Saturday, it was in March, it was my birthday weekend. It was very exciting. Every year for my birthday weekend, I bring my kids to the indoor water park. Amazingness of the Great Wolf Lodge. This podcast is not sponsored by the Great Wolf Lodge, but I will plug them.
Amen.
Because it's such a fun place. And I was going to go there. I was going to join with my good pal, Jonathan Miller, who was also bringing his children for that weekend. We had this whole thing planned. It was going to be great. Saturday morning, I get up. I drive my oldest son to his baseball tryouts, drop him off. I head back home, and I'm sitting on the couch just relaxing, kind of like setting up for the day, looking at my phone, my calendar, alongside my girlfriend. We're kind of like comparing notes to see, you know, kind of like what the weekend's going to be, what the week is going to be. And while I was sitting down, kind of like lean back in a, you know, cross-legged, my normal posture, sitting on a soft, comfy couch, I felt
chilling.
Like a little, yeah, exactly. I felt like a little discomfort in my chest. And it was like the same kind of discomfort you would have if you were sitting kind of cockeyed, you know, like it felt like a, not even a cramp, just like kind of like, you know, ah, that's, I'm sitting kind of funny, got weird, you know, a lung thing happening.
We're fellows of a certain age. We're used to like having a weird twing or something, right?
A weird twinge everywhere. It always happens.
Yep.
Not unlike how it's happened in the past. So I just kind of like, I stand up, I change my posture. I kind of like, you know, do the whole man, like stretch out my chest, you know, just to see if it's like something I need to loosen up. And it was fine. Like it was still just discomfort. In the same moment, my daughter calls for me to come upstairs. Dad, help me come pack my suitcase. I'm like, no problem. I'll be right up. And I walk up the stairs. And as soon as I got to the top step, the discomfort turned into a sharp pain in my chest. And it was enough of a sharp pain, probably like a 7 out of 10, to kind of like take me off my feet. I was on my back. My daughter was obviously very concerned, and it wasn't getting any better. It was like progressing. It was like it was a very sudden thing, you know? And, I called downstairs to my girlfriend. I'm like, can you come up here, please? And I was, you know, very urgent with my voice. So she knew something was up, you know, and she came right up. And I'm like, I'm having really bad chest pains. And by the time that she got up there, this is, again, you know, less than a minute that this is all taking place, 2 minutes maybe. It's gotten worse and worse. And like just in such a short period of time. And she's like, do you want to go to the hospital? I'm like, yeah, I think I do. Like it's hurting really bad. You know, panic kind of sets in a little bit for both of us. I think we kind of realize that this could be something serious. And she asks if I can stand up on my feet, and I'm like, I think so, yeah. So I get up on my feet. I begin to lumber down, you know, I should say lurch down the stairs towards the car. And before I do, I remember my daughter was kind of still standing there waiting for me to pack the suitcase, you know, like,
yeah.
And she witnessed all this kind of transpiring and was very concerned. And before I walked down the stairs, I gave her a hug and I told her I loved her, you know, because I felt like something was happening, you know?
Yeah.
So I walked downstairs, and before getting into the car, I crunched on some baby aspirin, you know, just in case this is the thing, you know. I'm kind of still holding out on hope that it's a panic attack. And just to give the listeners some context, that can't see me right now, I don't know if you can, you know, judge a book by its cover or anything, but regardless of whether or not you could see me, I'm 45 at the time. I was turning 46. I live very, very clean. I exercise. I work out in the gym 5-6 times a week. I eat chicken breast and broccoli. That's my most normal lunch. I eat salmon and rice for my most normal dinner. I don't smoke. I don't often drink. I sleep pretty well. I have a pretty healthy way of dealing with stress and, you know, conflict in my life. Everything is pretty good. So I'm still sitting here holding out on hope that this is something else, you know, because it's like, you know, I'm checking all the boxes. I'm doing all the things here. So please, like, let's, you know, give me a break. So I get down to the car. My girlfriend, you know, tells her son, who's much older than my kids, to keep an eye on the kids. Like, something's happening. I'll fill you in later. You know, we rush out the door. We're in the car. And within a block, I've got the seat for the car all the way reclined. And I remember I was kind of like sitting with my knees pulled up to my chest, and I'm gripping my chest with my hand, you know, kind of like the quintessential picture that you would see for, like, if you Google like heart attack and then Google search images, it's the guy clenching his chest with his right arm and, you know, and wincing in pain. And this is me, like, in the fetal position upright on a chair in a car. And we're driving towards the nearest hospital. And it was, geography kind of matters. I don't expect that a lot of our listeners know the cities, but I will say it just in case. The closest one was about a 12-minute drive, Burnsville. And we were on our way, and I remember literally within a couple of minutes to a few minutes of this drive, it hadn't stopped progressing. It was getting worse. A 7 went to an 8, an 8 went to a 9. John, I was at a 10 out of 10 pain. I was like moaning, and I remember in those moments, like in those first couple of minutes, I'm like, Sarah, I love you. Please tell my kids that I love them. And she's like, stop doing that right now. Stop that. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'm like, I'm literally making my peace with this place. And I want to make sure that the boxes are checked and I'm not missing anything. Cause I think I'm done. I'm going downhill really fast.
Yeah,
it was scary. It was the worst pain I've ever felt. It was leaking down my arm. Four minutes into it, the pain was still getting worse, you know, above a 10, whatever that is. This one goes to 11.
Yeah.
And I start feeling like my entire upper body from my waist up kind of going numb, like tingling sensations, my face, my chest, the pain's gone all the way down my arm at this point. And I knew I felt like I was losing consciousness. So I looked over and in a very faint voice, because I couldn't muster any strength to even speak, I told Sarah, I'm like, Sarah, you have to call 911. I'm not going to make it. And she whips up her phone. She calls 911 and the dispatcher on the line is trying to coach me through, like, you know, focus on your breathing. And I'm like, I'm just kind of like, I'm waning, you know, I have no energy to even do anything, let alone like try to like think about that. And he's like, pull over. He needs to be in an ambulance. We're in a parking lot of like this pizza place, which is probably terrible business for them. And fire trucks and an ambulance show up like within 3 or 4 minutes. I think we lucked out. There's a few different pieces where we lucked out. I'll recap those after I'm done. But ambulance is there right on the scene. Paramedics quickly get me into a stretcher and into the ambulance. And they take a quick scan of my chest. And they're like, yeah, it's go time. We need to get to the hospital immediately. So I've got nitroglycerin under my tongue. And for those that don't know what nitro does, It kind of like loosens up all of your arteries and veins. It kind of makes them almost gelatinous so that things can work their way through them, you know. It saves you from a heart attack, essentially.
Yeah, vasodilator probably is
you
what
got
that's
it.
Doing. Yep.
I get oxygen in my nose. I've got IVs in both arms. I'm getting, I think, morphine for the pain, something for the pain. And I'm sitting there just gripping my chest, you know, and it hasn't gotten better, but I'm strapped down and I can't pull my knees up to my chest anymore because everything's tied down. And, you know, I'm getting between the dispatcher on the 911 call, the paramedics by the car putting me in the stretcher and in the back of the ambulance, I was asked like a million questions. Most of them are repeated. And so we're being whisked off to the hospital. And I remember sitting there and I just like I was going, man, I was just so gone. And I looked up at the paramedic. I had one opportunity to kind of open my eyes because this entire time they were squinted shut. I could not open my eyes.
Wow.
And I looked at the guy and I said, am I going to make it? And this is the most haunting answer you could ever get from a paramedic and from a guy who's been doing this for, you know, however many years. He said, you're in good care. We're going to take good care of you.
Jesus.
And it was a long pause before he answered, am I going to make it? We're going to take good care of you. And I was just like, shit, I'm not going to make it. This is it.
Yeah.
The drive to the hospitals, seemed like, you know, forever. We get there, I'm being wheeled down what seems like a maze of hallways that takes forever. You know, just every moment was an eternity. And I remember that distinctly too, during this. And for those that, you know, if I wasn't clear that I'm having a heart attack, like it was very clear at this point. As soon as I got in the ambulance, wasn't anything
which
else.
Which is why it was horrible advertising for the pizza place.
Horrible advertising for the pizza place. They saw a guy being wheeled on the stretcher. And one thing that's my girlfriend does remember too is that she was also talking to other paramedics on the other side of the car. And when she had a chance to look back over me, I was on the stretcher being wheeled into the ambulance, except they covered my head. So she was like in a sheer panic that I had passed already. You know?
Oh my
She's
God.
Like, what's happening? Why? And I guess like they probably do that to protect your identity and stuff like that, you know, I guess.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
But Again, you know, terrible publicity for this pizza place. They're like, oh my God, that guy must have had the pepperoni.
Oh my God.
He's gone. So being wheeled down a maze of hallways and this is one thing I remember distinctly about this. And I think we'll kind of go. I want to get through the story and then talk some aftermath stuff here, like hindsight things. Yeah. But I remember it being wheeled down the hallway and I remember like, I'm just literally thinking about the next 1 second of my life, the next two seconds, 1 second, you know, the next breath I'm going to take, the next one light I'm going to pass on the ceiling. My eyes are shut, but I can sense them going past, you know. I'm literally thinking about the next second. And that was wild because, like, I think oftentimes, you know, we as humans, we project our minds so much into the future. Like, I'm going to think about, like, next week I'm going to a party. Next month I'm going on a trip. Uh-huh. Next year I'm planning on, you know, doing something big, or like in 10 years I'm going to retire. Like, all these things that we have in our brains in the future. And everything is just sucked back in an instant. And I'm thinking about 1 second in my future. And it's just like the thing I probably will remember the most about being wheeled down the hallway, other than being in like terrible pain. I get to where the cath lab is, where they're going to do the procedure. And like, I'm just gone, man. Like, I literally was making my peace, you know, like
in my mind. All that's going through your head is just get to the next light in the hallway. Like, there's nothing else really. Yep. Even
the next breath. That's so that wild. Was it. That was, yeah. My next breath was the only thing I thought of. That's it.
Wow. That's intense, man.
Yeah. And like, like the amount of pain that I was experiencing, I was incapable of thinking of anything else.
Yeah.
Like, there was just nothing else. There's no room for anything else. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get wheeled into the cath lab. I get to see my girlfriend and her friend Anne Marie right next to her. Just as I go past there, and I'll tell you some hindsight things about all of those interactions too in a moment, but I get into the cath lab, and it was the one of the wildest things that looked like a scene from a TV show or a movie. There was like what seemed to be 20 people just standing there staged, ready to take me in.
God, that's and, like, crazy. They can fire that up that fast, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Everything from the cardiologist that was doing the procedure to all of his assistants and nurses. And then there was people there observing with clipboards and pens ready to go. Jeez. And I remember, too, I was laying down on the table. They transferred me to the table, and like in my line of sight was like these two girls who appeared to be college aged, and they were just taking notes. And like, you know, all I could do was make eye contact with them because they were just like directly in front of me. It was kind of like a little bit interesting. I remember that part. And then what seemed to be like an instant, I've got, you know, a line going up my femoral artery in my leg. And the cardiologist that's working on the procedure is getting in there. And like, I can see this all on the monitor. I was given
morphine. You're awake for this?
I'm awake for this. I was given morphine. I could see this all on the monitor. I'm kind of watching things transpire, and I don't understand what I'm seeing. So it was just completely wild. And then literally once the blockage was cleared and they put a stent in me, the pain went away instantly. It was like from a pain level, because the morphine cut it down to like an 8 or 9. From an 8 or 9 pain level to a 0 in an instant. It was wild. So then I'm just kind of left there, you know, just kind of like loosey-goosey from the morphine and just like the whole, like, it was a very eerie feeling that the pain was gone. Like, I was 2 minutes before that, I was making my peace with this world. I was, you know, I was saying my goodbyes, and like 2 minutes later, the blockage is cleared and like I have no pain. I was like, this is crazy.
Did you have like a rush of, I don't even know what it is.
Yes.
Like endorphins or something that like relief or clarity?
Maybe not endorphins,
or
but like you, something? Like you could, I could feel like it was, it's weird because like the initial pain in my chest was in that top left area, like right where the blockage was. Like, this is all hindsight stuff too. And I could feel like that just kind of like moving through, you know, like I could feel it moving through, and it was so, it's indescribable. I can't even describe exactly what the sensation was, but no, it was crazy.
Wow.
I finish up in there, and then a couple hindsight things there. The cardiologist that was working on me, and this is, I'm going to recap that later because it's part of the main message here. They finish up my procedure. They wheel me off to recovery. I'm in there for a little while before they let Sarah and Anne-Marie come in. And while we were kind of sitting in there, just kind of like scheduling like the tests and all the things for the day, because this is still like late morning at this point. So they're kind of like, nurses are coming in and they're kind of writing up things on the board, and they're, you know, I'm being wired into the matrix. I got like, you know, again, IVs and sensors and oxygen and everything. No oxygen at this point, but just everything's connected to me, you know, like EKG, you know, sensors on my chest, and everything's on there. I got this big, you know, gauze bandage around my leg where my artery was, is, and I shouldn't say was, it wasn't removed. And two or three of the nurses that came in each said the same thing. They said, congratulations on changing the course of your life. You saved your life by acting fast. From the moment that I felt discomfort in my chest until the moment I was getting a stent put in was 40 minutes. And the crazy thing is, that seemed like, you know, an eternity for me. Like, it was so long because of just how significant that pain was for me. And it was just wild to have them all kind of congratulate me on, you know, saving my life and congratulate my girlfriend on saving my life.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like from what I've heard about how serious this was, staying alive for 40 minutes was kind of heroic on its own.
Yeah. Right. Now some, like, that's, we'll go through some hindsight stuff and some stats and aftermath things here, but some stats. I've seen a pretty wide array of odds, but if you search Google right now, you need to search, and I'm just going to do it because we used to start do Google search as part
sure,
of our
JP Google something,
right? If you search the survival rate on the Widowmaker heart attack, it says reports from the American Heart Association show that only 12% of people suffering the Widowmaker heart attack outside the hospital get to survive, and 25% of people that suffer this heart attack in a hospital survive. You're given a 1 in 4 chance if you have it while you're in a hospital that has a cath lab, and 12% to survive if you're not in a hospital.
Holy crap.
This is just something that's rocked me, you know, and I'm lucky to be walking and breathing and talking and
no kidding.
Needless to say, that's why, you know, part of the reason for such a big break for us is that, you know, I've been recovering. The aftermath has been a significant amount of cardiac rehab, lots of pills. Many of them I'll be on for the rest of my life. Not many, you know, huge changes in my diet, but there's going to be, you know, I'm being careful. Like, these first few months are very crucial for the damage that was done to my heart to be healed. I'm still waiting on that prognosis, TBD, at some point this summer. Now here's some hindsight stuff. So it's a very serious story. I got to see my kids that day. It was very emotional, man. Like, I'm, you know, I didn't know if I was going to see them again. And that's why I'm wearing my only dad's hat for this message here today, but, and you're joining me.
Amen.
I didn't know if I was going to make it. I didn't know if I was going to see my kids again. You know, and that's the kind of the biggest thing here. And, I want to say the whole purpose of this message is self-advocacy. In fact, I'm sure this podcast episode is going to be titled something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. So when my brother, my older brother, was 40, this is about 7 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, he suffered the same heart attack. And I want to go through his story because it's wild too, but I'll keep it brief. Myself and my sister both went in after that. He survived it. Myself and my sister both went in, and I think this is kind of pretty normal. Like, a lot of people around you will be like, well, shit, I should check my stuff too, right?
Uh-huh.
My sister and I did that. I went in for an EKG, an echocardiogram, a stress test, lipid panel, and everything looked pretty good. Like, all of those physical tests were good. And my lipids, which basically measures your cholesterol, triglycerides, all the things that are indicators for heart disease, those are all right too. Like, I had some things that were like kind of a little off, you know, and some things that were kind of not. But overall, pretty decent. And I, like, my doctor wasn't too concerned about it, my regular doctor that I saw. I think he said, if you feel comfortable, we can put you on a prescription of Lipitor. I'm not really too sure if you need it because, like, you know, your brother lives a way different lifestyle than you. And I'm talking, I want to try to be filtered about this, but, like, a way, way different lifestyle.
Sure.
Smoking, drinking, different, you know, physical labor. Like, he works his ass off on a hot roof, like, you know, roofing. Diet was way different. Everything was way, way different. Like, things that would lead you to believe that, yeah, this is, you know, he put himself in a pretty tough spot for his heart. Every doctor kind of chalked it up to that. And that's where the mistake was for me. You know, like, when I'm gonna keep going in and out of like aftermath stuff. When I was in the cath lab shortly after the stent was put in by this cardiologist, this guy was a character. Like, he was a straight shooter, no bullshit. He looked at me in the eye and he says, "Why the fuck weren't you on cholesterol medicine?" And I'm like, I was put on the defensive, but I'm like,
wow.
I live really clean. I exercise constantly. I'm always in the gym. I eat very clean. I don't smoke. I rarely drink, and I sleep well. Like, I was listing off all these things. He's like, "That doesn't fucking matter." He's like, that might be 10 or 20% of it. It's all genetics and other variables. Like, it's great that you did those things and you probably saved your life as a result of, you know, you built some strength in your heart, and you might not have survived if you hadn't done those things. But those things won't prevent you from having blockages. Like, it's all, like I said, genetics and other variables. And I was like, well, son of a bitch. And that's
even
why
when
like,
your cholesterol is decent, even when your numbers are decent and not out of whack.
Yeah. And here's the thing. And I don't want to use scare tactics to, you know, force our listeners to take action.
Yeah.
But I do want you to like be aware of like your family history and like other variables that can be out there, like stress. And you know, I have some theories about other things, you know, more recent things, but like as far as like inflammation things that you can't factor, and genetics, because like maybe the curvature of that artery that by the way, it's the LAD, which is the main artery that supplies blood, oxygenated blood to your heart. So like that was shut off for 40 minutes. But maybe there's like genetically, you know, kind of a pinch in that because of the curvature. You know, I might have developed, you know, differently than a more healthy version of that artery or whatever. But yeah. I'm encouraging people to be their own advocate and trying not to do this through fear. But I was speaking with a friend of mine, one of my best friends in the world, Joe Cibula. He was just on our podcast recently. Actually, I think it might have been our most recent episode, right? He joined us for the most recent episode for this season. He is really good friends and business partners with a guy who's like heavily entrenched in the fitness industry. He's like U.S. Men's Health Magazine 100 most fit men in the U.S. He's former UFC. He was recently on the Ultimate Fighter, like UFC reality TV show. And this guy is a tank. Like he lives every single day for fitness. And like he is the shining, he is exactly who you want to have as your coach. His name's Bobby Maximus. And Bobby called me like about a week removed from this. And he's like, "I want to give you my perception of this because my dad passed from this. And
shit.
The last 20 years I live every day for this stuff, you know, and if I'd known this about you, I wish we would have talked." But he said many things, but one of the things that stood out most was that you have to look at your lipid panel differently, your cholesterol numbers differently. So like if you're the type of person, and I'm talking to you, the listener right now, if you're the type of person who lives above the average American male, like you're working out, you're not smoking, you're not drinking much, you sleep well, your diet is good. If that's your case also, if like you're like I am, your numbers shouldn't be anywhere close to the average. They should be way better than the average.
Really?
Because you live so much cleaner than that person. Those numbers are based on like the average American male who's smokes 2.5 cigarettes a week, who drinks 3.5 drinks per day or per night or whatever, who doesn't exercise more than, you know, once every couple of weeks or whatever. You
Eats
can't grade yourself
fries.
On that average scale. You have to grade yourself on a curve scale. There's no calculator to show you where you should score. So the fact that I was like around average or below average for some of those things should have been a huge red flag for me. I need to be looking at those differently. And I think fortunately and unfortunately, so the fortunate thing is like the way that I live probably saved my life. It built some strength in my heart. But the way that I lived kind of masked my numbers a little bit, you know, like since my dietary cholesterol is pretty good and I exercise a lot and, you know, process through things, like that probably masked my numbers a little bit to some degree. And it probably kind of hid the fact that I probably needed to have some sort of, you know, medicinal intervention at some point throughout the course of time here. So, but anyway,
that's so hard. Like when you go to a doctor and you get the numbers and they tell you like, you could be on something or maybe you don't need to be. And then you just go, all right, well, I'm living clean. And the doctor says, I'm fine. So be it. Go about my day. I'll just chill here on the couch and not worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And real quick, too, just to briefly touch on my brother's story. So he was 40. I want to zip back because I think I got sidetracked from that. He was 40, had the same thing. Again, different lifestyle. He had his while he was, I don't know if I've told you this, Miller, but he was 10 feet underwater, snorkeling, reaching for a conch shell 1 mile off the shore in Key West.
Oh, my God.
And he felt like he thought like something, a stinging sensation in his left arm. He thought it was a jellyfish. So he kind of like looked around. He's like, what the fuck was that? Because he says he was reaching for a conch shell and then he felt that. And then like he just felt weird, you know, weak, weird. So he kind of like floated to the surface and he like just floated there for a little bit trying to figure out what was going on. And he felt like a significant amount of what felt like heartburn. It wasn't the same like severe pain that I had. He felt like heartburn and like that weird stinging sensation in his arm was kind of like subsiding a little bit. So he like backstrokes. There's no boat. He swam out to this coral reef. He backstrokes his way to the shore. He gets to the shore and he's exhausted. You know, he's sitting there slumped on the shore for a few minutes, just trying to figure out what's going on. And then he's like, yeah, I'm not feeling right. So he gets up and he walks back to their camp, which is a mile away.
Oh, my God.
So he hikes back a mile through, you know, oceany, you know, terrain.
Yeah, mangroves or something.
Exactly. I think at that point he like calls my mom and he says, you know, this is what happened. And my mom's like, I think you're having a heart attack. And he's like, no, I'm 40. You know, I'm like, he's not overweight. Like he's a pretty skinny dude too. Like at this time, like he, you know, he's fit because of his physical labor that he does for a job. And so and my mom's kind of like, yeah, you're probably right. Like, but you know, she didn't feel right about that. But and his buddy that he was there with is like, you know, maybe let's just go relax. So they decided to walk like another mile up the shore to a Wendy's to get a burger.
over rocks
and beachy terrain again.
Oh my
Gets a burger and still doesn't feel right. And at this point, he calls my mom back and says, and told her it's not going away. It's been like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. And she's like, Andy, I think you need to go to the hospital. I think you're having a heart attack. And he's like, yeah, all right, I'll go. So he goes. And again, I think they walk back to their camp, they get in a car and they drive down to the nearest clinic because it was, you know, middle of the day during the week. And he walks into this clinic, you know, kind of in beach attire. And he's like, yeah, I think I'm having a heart attack. And they're like, okay. And they look, you know, kind of look at him and he sits down and they're like, why don't you wait here and we'll have you fill out some paperwork.
Jesus, no.
So he's in the waiting room doing his thing. You know, I don't think they believed him, obviously. And then they bring him back to the room and they take a test of like a blood test. I can't remember what the chemical it is that gets released in your bloodstream when you're having a heart attack. It's some sort of like, you know, like your heart's like, fuck, and it's sending out like stress chemicals in your body.
Yeah.
And he had like, it was, I can't remember what the number, what the reading was, but it was very, very high. And they're like, oh shit, you're having a huge heart attack right now. And everybody's kind of like, what's going on? He gets airlifted to Mount Sinai Heart Hospital in Miami, where he gets like multiple stents put in and he's there for like a week or whatever.
Oh my God.
But that's his Chuck Norris heart attack story that he survived. It's just a complete wild story, but yeah, so it's in my genes, you know, like there's not a ton else out there in my family's history, but like that's enough, you know.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
enough for me to step up and have some self-advocacy and be like, you know, if my doctor says everything looks pretty good, so like whatever, like I gotta be more curious about that. I trust my doctor, but I don't know that if given the opportunity to say, you know, like I'm going to die if I don't trust you. I don't know if I trust him with my life. You know what I'm saying?
100%. Yeah. I feel the same way about my doctor. I think he's great, but like when he's an older guy and when he sees me walk in, he always goes, oh, you're young and you're fit and whatever. And sure, we'll test your lipids, but you know, I'm sure it's nothing to worry about. Come back in a year. But you know, those general practice guys are there to like, diagnose significant issues and pass you off to somebody else. And I think sometimes you need to, right now I'm doing that right now with him. Like I, after this all happened with you, I went in and got my shit tested pretty quick. Yeah. And now I'm looking at the results and going like, okay, you don't think this is a big deal, but I kind of want to have somebody else look and just, you know, get a second opinion, or what's the next one down the line from you, just to make sure that we're covering our bases here. It's not, you know, it whatever the copay is on seeing a specialist for a single visit just to check up on you is not worth getting into an ambulance in a couple of years and,
yeah,
you know, wishing you could have done something about it.
Yeah. Now I'm going to go to the lighter side of things here. I will, like, just in true JP fashion, because, I, you know, I did think I was dying and I was going to go out my way. So, like, the whole time I was cracking jokes like a dumbass. So
yeah, I heard that.
One of them, I remember I was in the ambulance and the guy that was kind of taking the lead on things, the main paramedic, he says, "Mr. Hurley, we need to keep you talking to make sure that you stay awake. You're like, I need you to stay with me. So we're going to keep talking to you." And he's like, "You know, what's your favorite sport?" And I'm like, what the fuck am I, like, 6 years old here?
Nine years old. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't say that, but I'm like, I don't football. And he's like, "Ah," he's like, "Yeah. Are you a Vikings fan?" I'm like, "Yeah. In fact, that's the whole reason that I had my heart attack is because I'm a Vikings fan." And I could tell, like, they're probably trained to, like, not laugh about things, because, like, he felt the gravity of the situation and he's, like, holding back laughter, you know. And I was just like, okay, this is gonna be a challenge, but, you know, I'm also dying over here. As soon as I got to the cath lab, at that moment before they put me into the room, when I did see my girlfriend Sarah and her friend Anne Marie, Sarah asked me, like, if I needed anything or how I am, and I remember saying something like, yeah, can you get me a THC seltzer? Or, like,
that's what I heard too.
I had a shirt on before I got in here. Like, do you know where my shirt is? And I'm like, I don't know why I'm concerned about my shirt, because I'm dying.
I also cut the shirt, did they? It's my favorite shirt.
Exactly. I also remember, like, Sarah, you know, is very good about reminding me that I did this, but I asked Sarah to call you so that you could cancel my Great Wolf Lodge reservation so I could get my money back.
Yeah. She said you were very mostly concerned about getting your money back. At Great
I'm going to need
Lodge
that for the funeral. Yeah.
Yeah.
really important to get that refund, I guess. I don't remember that part, which is hilarious because there's some things I didn't remember because I was, like, drugged up in some
funny
cases. But inside the cath lab, there's literally 20 people waiting on me hand and foot and, like, you know, doing all these things. And I just kind of, like, you know, after the stent went in and, like, things were kind of clearing up and the pain went away, I kind of realized pretty quickly that, like, they spared nothing for me, you know, and I felt really warm about the amount of people and, like, how many they seemed like they cared, from the paramedics in the ambulance and the first responders and the fire trucks to the, you know, the nurses and the cardiologists and even the people taking notes. Everybody was very, you know, careful and cautious and sensitive and helpful. And it was amazing.
Pros,
it was really amazing.
Right?
So I kind of, like, realized
exactly what to do.
Yeah. This was a huge lift. And then those two things, I want to give you those two hindsight things before kind of giving, like, a final message on this portion. And then I want to roll into your stuff too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I remember there were two pivotal points in this entire experience. One of them was Sarah and I were on our way to that Burnsville hospital that was nearby. Mm-hmm. And had we not pulled over and called 911, I might not have made it, because that hospital was not staffed. They would have had to put me in an ambulance, turn me around and send me down the road. I don't think I would have made it. Number two, obviously the baby aspirin, I don't think I would have made it if it weren't for that either. Uh-huh. Just like kind of like ever since my brother had his 8 years ago, I've kept baby aspirin in my backpack with me. And I think in a perfect world, I would have had nitroglycerin with me. You're supposed to just toss one of those under your tongue if you're, you know, having chest pain or whatever, if you're feeling like you're having a heart event. But a very nice close second is chucking down four of those baby aspirins. Super lucky that I thought about that as we were heading out the door. I don't know if I would have made it without that either, you know, like,
yeah.
And there's probably a couple more very touchy instances like that where I probably wouldn't have made it had this not happened, had we not decided right away, you know. Very fortunate. I am the quintessential example of guy who realizes he's got a second chance. In fact, I'm reminded of a quote. I don't know if you've heard this one before. But they say, every man has two lives. And his second one begins when he realizes he only has one.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm Second Life guy right now.
Yeah. How could you not be?
And the main point here is, this is kind of, I'm going to summarize it by saying this about self-advocacy. The thing about comfort, like when you're kind of lulled into a sense of comfort and confidence that you're fine, you're not going to be that guy that's going to like have that chest pain. The thing about comfort is it gets, I'm going to quote my friend Joe on this one too, it gets really comfortable. And it's really easy to kind of sit back.
It's wiser than it sounds. It's really wise. Yeah.
It's easy to sit back and, you know, let others advocate for you. Let your doctor, you know, it's not his fault. Like, he's practicing medicine.
Yeah.
That's why it's practice. And
well, and how many guys does he see with the same numbers and the same things? And
got
and
guys live in way different shape, you know, guys that are older. It's easy to kind of fall away from being your own advocate. And this goes for not just your health, this goes for your employment. Like, it's easy to kind of like be comfortable in your current position and not challenge or stretch yourself to be curious about what could be more, what's best for me. Being a father, it's easy to kind of like sit back, put cruise control on and just be comfortable with like status quo and not challenge yourself to being a better dad, being a better mom. It's easy to every aspect of life. It's really easy to kind of like recline back in the chair and just let things happen to you instead of taking some control. And I just want everybody to kind of challenge the way that you think about your life at every aspect and be your own advocate. Be the person that's kind of on the front line for yourself. You're the only person that gets affected by your life being at risk or all of these other things, you know? So I want you to kind of like challenge yourself to think a little bit differently. And for God's sake, if you got some genetics in your family, any heart disease in the family or anything like that, you probably should be crunching on Lipitor from, you know, your 30s on. Like, unfortunately, it's not great, but you probably should be. And there's other tests you can take. Happy to throw them in the show notes here, but I want to close things off with that message.
No, I think that's good. At a bare minimum, be seeing somebody besides the general practitioner more regularly and just pay better attention to that stuff. I think it's kind of like when you say self-advocacy, I almost hear the way you're describing it as just keep stuff in focus. Like talking about parenting, like you can sit and scroll on your phone all day, or you can focus on your kids. You can take the numbers they give you every year when you get your blood drawn or whatever, every couple of years, and focus on something else. Or you can look at that and go, I should probably focus on this a little bit. I should probably call for a follow-up appointment. I should probably either take their advice, or if they want me to take some drugs, I'll take the drugs. Or is there something else I should be doing with my diet? Or is there another thing I can be, whatever it is. That's kind of what I hear when you say self-advocacy. My related story, since we kind of teed it up, and probably won't spend a ton of time on this, but my son was in the hospital for the last, well, for four about a 48-hour stretch, leading up to like 2 days ago he got out, and what started out with as a flu turned into a host of other issues that meant that we had to go from our clinic to Children's Hospital and back to our clinic and to Children's Hospital again, because the clinic just didn't have the testing that the hospital did to be able to determine if he was getting better or if he wasn't. And there was so much there, and like everybody we dealt with at the clinic, and it was, you know, it was just him and me going back and forth. Everybody we saw was fantastic. Like they're great at what their job is, but sometimes their job as just a straight up pediatrician isn't to fix something like this, and they have to send you somewhere else. And it was interesting, because it was like the regular pediatrician, you know, would say, you know, you can give this some time and see if this clears up. But I would take him to Children's right now. And have them make sure, you know, have somebody who's probably seen more of this, take a look at them and make sure. And then you go to Children's and you wait, you know, and you go, oh God, it's going to be, they run you through like an ER every time. So you got to sit in the ER room with other people, and it's hours and hours before you get seen. And then you get seen, and then they start working, they start diagnosing and doing things and like running IV and things like that to clear this up. And then the numbers start coming back down and you go, okay, great. And they say, you know, well, here again, you can take him home and see how it goes, or you can stay here overnight and start trying to add up like, well, he doesn't want to spend the night in the hospital. He seems like he's getting better. They're telling me that this thing clears itself up. It's just a matter of time, you know, and you kind of have to do the math of like, what do you do in this situation? Like, you are the ultimate decider, right? They're not going to tell you, they can't tell you, you have to stay here. They're going to let you out if you're an idiot and you say, I'm leaving, you know, or if they're on the fence, they're definitely going to leave that up to you. So we just had a lot of back and forth, and with a thing that was kind of nebulous and hard to pin down as to when he was going to get better, and, you know, chose that day to come home and let him sleep in his own bed. And then went back to our clinic the next day and same thing, numbers too high to measure, got to go back to Children's. And that second time we went back, you know, waited 4 hours to see a doctor again. And, but by the time we did see a doctor that night, he was like already substantially better. And, we got to come home that night again, and he's been just fine. He went back to school this week. So, it's like, I think number one, he had some interesting like symptoms. After having a flu, he started having like leg pains, and that just didn't make any sense to me. And while his flu was getting better, the leg pains were so weird that I thought, you know, I could wait for this to clear up on its own, or I could take him in. And I'm glad I did take him in, because when we got in there, I was explaining everything to the doctor, that the pediatrician that we saw, and she was the same. She was like, yeah, this is really weird. I don't know what to do with this, but it's not normal. So let's get you somewhere, you know.
Creepy.
So from that point on, you know, like, just like, man, it's so hard. It's hard to swallow the pill of like, all right, I'm going to be paying for like an ER visit. That sucks. You know, it's like, well, you got to do it. You got to go in there and you got to do it. You got to have them look at him. And then every path down the road is, well, this isn't done yet. You're going to have to keep doing more of this and keep sitting through these, sit in this waiting room and sit in this doctor's office and get him, you know, draw more blood, which was, poor kid got stuck like five times. And just a freak out every time. And I get it. He's not, you know, he's never had that happen before. So that was his biggest concern, was, are they going to stick me again? You know, it was heavy. It was really heavy. But like, I guess, like, to roll it into the theme of this show, you really have to make the best decision you can make, and not just go along with whatever's going on. Like, I made damn sure every time we left our clinic and we're going to Children's, like, are you sending the records you have? Are you sending the paperwork over there so that they know what you're dealing with here? And then when I showed up at Children's, they have paperwork back there. You know, if they don't have it, you tell me and I'll get it for you. And then when we got in to see a doctor to see a nurse that second night, they just kind of process you like you're everybody else. Every time you go into the ER, I mean, we had been there the night before and had to give them the same story again, had to give them the same rundown again. And I get it. It's an ER. That's what they're there for. They're not there to see people two nights in a row. They're there to process you and either get you into a hospital or get you home.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is what it is. So you gotta walk in there prepared with the paperwork in hand and go, this is what's going on. I was here last night. Here's what he needs. I can tell you what he needs. You need to draw his blood right now so we can check what he's got, because the other clinic can't test for it. And you need to get an IV going on him right now. And she, you know, okay, you know, ran back and talked to the doctor, who luckily was the same doctor as we saw the night before. Got like the tests ordered and whatever else. And an hour or two later, we were going home. But, you know, you can't just trust that you're going to show up in a place and they're going to know what to do with you. You kind of have to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, that's a good message there too. That's, I remember kind of chit-chatting with you briefly throughout that whenever you could. And
yeah,
I remember you said that you were kind of like in activator mode during all of that, making sure he gets the next thing, like next thing, being, you know, like a good dad and trying to like be on top of it. And then I remember like it was a day later after like he's back home and things are kind of like calming down. You kind of like broke down a little bit.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I was the first day was about 9, 10, it was about 12 or 14 hours of being in and out of the doctor and the hospital and then back. And then he got into bed on, I think it was Thursday night. And I was just like, God, I hope this works. It feels like it's working. And if he goes, because I think he was supposed to be back with his mom that next day. And I just was like, if he goes back with his mom tomorrow, I'm taking the day off. And I'm just going to like stare into the distance because this was a lot. And it turned out we were back in the clinic the next day, Friday, and then at the hospital all night till 3 a.m. Saturday. So, it pulled a lot of stuff out of the woodwork for me. Like it pulled a lot of emotions out for me. And when he did finally stabilize and get a lot better, like he's a lot better now. He's going to be fine. But, and he went back to his mom's on that Saturday. I took about 5 minutes to drive back to my house, pack up my dog, and I went into the woods and I found a trail, and me and Leo dog just walked for like an hour and a half and just looked at the trees and looked at the river and looked at the horizon. And I needed that. I needed like, space. It was just, it was so heavy when you're dealing with your sick kid and he's scared and he's asking you questions about like, is this going to work? And you don't know. And he's tired of getting blood drawn and he hasn't slept right in 2 days and he's not eating anything. And, that's really hard. And on top of it, like you're trying to do your best to like co-parent or communicate with your co-parent at the same time. And that's going about as well as you can imagine it goes. It was a ton. Even yesterday, I was sitting here yesterday, talking about this and had to take about 5 minutes to go stand on the deck and cry because, it's just a lot. It's heavy. It kind of opened me up.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that last bit too, because I think that the majority of this podcast episode has been kind of about physical health, you know, but there's definitely some heavy mental health stuff interlaced within there, especially the aftermath. And I think that for your sake, for that story, thank you for sharing that. And then like the one that I just shared also, like there's some trauma in there, you know, and I think it's really important that if you've faced any sort of trauma like of that nature, and even like divorce or, you know, like a hard breakup or a death in the family
or a sick kid
or, you know, a car accident or like any significant, you know, significant is a relative term, but any significant amount of trauma, like take that shit serious, man. Like I will say this too, just to kind of advocate for mental health in those scenarios. I'm seeing a trauma therapist. It's like I'm just kind of like building up my portfolio of therapists at this point, but I'm severely affected by what happened to me. Just like you kind of said, you went out on the deck and you were in tears. Mm-hmm. I've done the same thing several times in the last few weeks. I was in my first day back to work. I think I waited 2 weeks and went back to work because I was bored out of my damn brain.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was like important for my mental health to kind of get back into the swing of things because I was physically kind of back.
You're not a sit around kind of guy.
No, not at all. It was a Monday morning. I was getting ready. I was in the closet putting like a shirt on and shoes and socks and a belt. And like, there's so many things. I had to brush my teeth. I had to fix my hair. I had to take a shower. I had to put deodorant. Honestly, it had been, you know, two and a half weeks since I had worked last. And I didn't remember how complex it is getting ready for fucking, there's so many things, you know, and I was kind of overwhelmed by it. you know, I was affected by, you know, some other things that were kind of happening in my life too at the same time. And I just remember kind of like having all of that negative momentum and just like things hit me all at once. And I kind of broke down crying, and I looked down as I'm getting ready, and I realized that, like, you know, this is the week that they could have been having my funeral. Or like, I remember hearing, this is the true story of it too. Another instance where I was just kind of by myself. I was in my car. I think I might've been driving to work like a few days later, and on my liked songs playlist, or like, you know, some of the songs that we listen to on Spotify.
Yeah.
A song came over my speakers that was kind of like a really important song for me and my kids. Like, we've become addicted to the movie, the new Wonka movie.
Yeah.
And one of the songs from that movie is like one of our favorite songs. It's For a Moment, it's called. Okay. And it's kind of like a very heartfelt, no pun intended, like touching song. And as I was listening to this song, my brain, being evil, you know, connected dots that didn't need to be connected, and thought that, like, had I not made it, my kids would be listening to this song in a whole different light. You know, like, this would be, you know, obviously it's cherished memories for us. Like, we've watched this movie together so many times.
Yeah.
We've listened to the songs. They could be experiencing all these things, and they're like sour or sad or dark moments for them because, like, you know, we shared them together, you know. And I was just like, broke down in tears again. I cried all the way to work. I cried. I was at the gym at my work. Luckily there wasn't a lot of people there, and I cried on the treadmill. Yeah. During my long walk, you know, as part of my rehabilitation. And I just, like, I left, I had to go back home because I couldn't, you know, stop crying, you know. And it's just so,
yeah.
Take that shit serious, and, you know, find what it is you need to nip that in the bud. Like, for me, like, I'm seeing a therapist. It's helping a lot. He specializes in trauma. But, like, you know, take that stuff serious and figure it out, because that builds up inside of you and it comes out in very unhealthy ways.
I don't know what your therapist is telling you, and maybe there's some things you can do and take action and kind of move yourself through this stage. But my uneducated, dunderheaded opinion is, you just got to cry that shit out, man. That's just gonna happen, you know. Like, it's okay.
I'm good with the, yeah, there's a healthy amount of it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's probably an unhealthy amount of, like, spiraling down and not letting yourself get back out, you know?
I think you got to move forward. You got to take steps. You got to do things. You have to stay productive, or try as best as you can. Stay, you know, take that dog out for an hour and a half walk and breathe the fresh air, and then, yeah, cry halfway home, or yeah, cry when you get home, and that's okay too.
Allow, like, yourself a halfway,
yeah,
cry.
Yeah. You can't just wallow. I heard an interesting podcast a few weeks ago with a woman who's been talking about therapy as it pertains to kids, and something she's seen in the research is, like, it can be detrimental sometimes to focus on your issues instead of moving past them, right? So there's definitely a level of, like, you have to keep putting one foot in front of the other, even when it's hard. But I think there's that, and then maybe that's how you grow and, like, build a, I don't know if I want to say a callus necessarily, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you get kind of torn open. You keep moving forward anyway. You give yourself space and a couple of minutes to catch your breath and be open and raw. And then you just keep moving forward anyway, and you grow that way.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to kind of wrap up our stories in a little nutshell, and maybe leave you an opportunity to kind of provide some final thoughts if you got any. Yeah, just this is all about advocacy and not letting yourself be lulled into a sense of comfort or, you know, confidence. And just be curious about yourself, about your body, about your mind, about all the aspects in your life, and just kind of, like, take those things in stride and take them serious and be your own advocate, man. That's what I got to say here.
Yeah, my only final thought addendum to that is that, and I don't know who else is as self-loathing as I am, but I kind of, like, thinking about like I should be doing this or I should be doing that, right? I should be seeing a doctor more regularly, or I should be doing more. I should be working out more, or I should be eating better, or I should be, you know, what, like, working on my house. Should have got that baseboard in this week. Didn't get it in. Like, that can feel all very negative. I don't know. Do you feel like that? Do you have stuff in your life where you're like, I should be doing this and I didn't do it, and now I'm going to shit on myself for it?
A little bit, yeah. Yep, I'm good at giving myself some grace, but yes, absolutely, I do that too.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I think the thing I'm trying to work on is a different kind of motivational tool, which is not to shit on myself for not doing stuff, but just to like look forward to like getting that off my list, or look forward to the progress of that. And like, I don't look at the wall. I'm looking at a piece of wall right now that I did a couple of weeks ago, and I have a couple of baseboard pieces to put on still. And I'm trying not to look at that wall and go, oh, you piece of shit, you still don't have that baseboard on there. I'm trying to look at it and go, oh, I'm going to finish that tonight. Sweet. You know, like it could be 4 years ago that I told myself I was going to do it. I'm going to do it. I mean, it's going to feel great. I'm not going to shit on myself for not having it done. Just, you know, pick some things, put them on a list and feel good about knocking them off there. Whether that's get your lipids and then talk to a specialist about it, or getting your baseboard nailed up, or taking your kids to the park when maybe you should have took them last week and you sat on the couch instead. Take them this week. Good. Fine. Quit digging in that shit.
What if the thing that's on your list is to shit on yourself? Are you going to shit on yourself for that?
That's for the bedroom, mister. We keep that in the bedroom.
No, that's shitting the bed, I think.
Oh, same thing. Come see, come saw. It's the same thing for me.
Sounds good. All right, you guys, that's all the time we got for this episode. We'll try to get back to being more regular, no pun intended with the shit jokes here, but we'll get as regular as we can. We'll get some more podcasts out there, some compelling topics. We want to say thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Also, make sure you check out our website, badweatherwellness.com. We'll get things spinning back up and filled with action on those websites. Follow us on all the social media platforms, Instagram, X, TikTok, @badweatherpod. And as always, you guys, thank you for listening. Bye.
Take very good care of yourselves. Bye-bye. I want to forget my bad days.